That's better than us freezing, I suppose. But on behalf of my colleagues, we welcome you this morning for the one case that we have on. It's my understanding that counsel for both sides have, or all the lawyers have, waived their opening period of uninterrupted. Hopefully you know what you're doing. But at any event, you'll be open for questions from the court. I just ask that you answer succinctly the questions that the court poses to you. Please be mindful of the clock there when you wind down to stop. But if you're in the middle of answering a judge's question, by all means, please do so. With that, we are ready to begin. We call the Mr. Ingram.
May it please the court. Ann Whitman, who has been counsel throughout this case for petitioner, has taken ill and called me at the end of last week and asked if I would be so kind as to step in and argue this for her, since she couldn't think of anybody else who could step in at the last minute and argue these, other than, since I've been teaching this for 34 years, she thought that would help. And so here I am, Your Honors, and I do waive the Roney rule, and I'm happy to answer your questions as you ask them. The disputes in this case and the Hudson case before it demonstrate why it's important that we be here today. Because the coverage enunciated under the Longshore Act in the Winchester case, as eight members of this court called extremely imprecise and nebulous, has plagued practitioners, professors, the industry, judges, and the like for over 30 years. In fact, the Hudson case is a perfect example of that, because under Winchester, in the Hudson case, the question is, what is that area? Is it a barge? Is it a barge and a platform? Is it all the wells that are whose oil is being loaded onto this barge? Is it the field? Is it the bay? That's what the court struggled with in Hudson. And the reason for that is because of the test, which was not a textual statutory test that the court enunciated in Winchester. Now, this court, I'm proud to say, has taken the lead so many times when its precedents were wayward, has taken the lead in correcting those, and I'm reminded of the last time I stood before the full court in Barrett versus Chevron. It's been a while. But the court dealt with the trouble with the seaman status test, and the court corrected that in its en banc decision, which became the guiding light for the Supreme Court, which the Supreme Court used to change the law of seaman status, and it's time that this court now take us out of the nebulous.
The point you're making, the Labor Department had disputed that there really has been much evidence of disarray as a result of Winchester and perhaps of Hudson. They talk about the limited number of cases that have come through. What is your evidence? It's one thing to say the neighborhood test, or whatever you want to call it, Winchester, is not well-rooted in the statute. It's something else to say that it's hard to apply. What is your evidence that it's hard to apply and that it's caused difficulties, or then occasionally we have to deal with it?
Well, if the perfect example of that is Hudson, because look at what the court had to deal with in Hudson. The court had to deal with the question of choosing what is the adjoining area. And we'll get to the textual part in a minute, but your question is excellent, because the point is we have a conflict with another court, with the Fourth Circuit directly, and that court chose to adopt into law what the eight dissenters from this court said in Winchester, and that is go textual, which is what the Supreme Court dictates. But I'll get to that in a minute. The point is that Hudson case alone and this case deal with, because the point in this case is, and I mentioned Hudson, where there are, is it the bay even? Because the one thing we know from Winchester, you talk about applying that, the one thing the court told us, the one thing, this is what they told us. And I'm actually telling you the truth here. This is what the court said. Downtown Houston is not covered. That's the one piece of advice we got from the court.
How far is the port from downtown Houston?
5 miles, approximately, Judge. 5 miles. And the thing is, when you talk about area and you get out of the text of the statute, that's the problem that you have. And it's not what Congress said either, and I'll get to those points as well. So the thing is that there are two major reasons for overturning Winchester, and this case presents you with the precise facts to do so. The precise facts, because this is what the administrative law judge Kennington found. He found that this is not, this area does not directly adjoin the waterfront, this yard, the Sheff Yard. It has no piers, it has no docks, it has no wharfs. It is 300 yards, not too much farther than the Mississippi River, from the Industrial Canal. It has no direct access to the water. It's landlocked. It is separated by numerous businesses. Most of those, at least from the record, are not maritime, but it is possible from the record that there are maritime businesses down the road, as the court noted, as the ALJ noted. Now, there are two reasons that are important to reconsider Winchester. One of those is that Winchester improperly replaced the decision of this court in Jacksonville Shipyards versus Purdue. And secondly,
You are talking about Winchester and the argument that it has been waived. Do you have any comment with respect to the fact that you
Yes,
waived
I do.
It?
And that's a good question, Your Honor, because the point is that from the outset, from day one of this, all the way through the ALJ up to this court, the petitioner said, tried to get around Winchester because of the adjoining area issue. And they cited the Ninth Circuit, they cited Sidwell from the Fourth Circuit was cited. And the administrative law judge expressly rejected application of the law of other circuits. So it's hard to argue that an issue was waived when it was directly addressed and discussed by the administrative law judge who rejected the law of the other circuits, saying that Winchester was controlling over him. And he had a nice recitative where he discussed Sidwell, he discussed the Ninth Circuit test in Hamilton Brady, and he discussed all those. But he said, I can't go there because of Winchester.
Well, at this level, when it came before the panel, though, you would agree that it wasn't briefed or argued to the panel to either distinguish Winchester or ask for it in bank or to take it head on. There just was a dispute over applying the law to the facts in this case. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I mean, do you agree with that?
No, I don't, because in the issues that were raised in the statement of issues to the panel, petitioner noted the ALJ had rejected application of the more restrictive tests from the other circuits, and they continued to try, because the panel is bound by Winchester, continued to try to distinguish it using the tests from the other courts and said, look, okay, we know Winchester says this, but look, the Ninth Circuit does this, and let's try and work within Winchester to move it over toward the way the Ninth Circuit does it like. En banc, we ask the court now not to just distinguish, although as an argument we have before you, it is clear that you can apply Winchester. And when you apply Winchester correctly under Schwab, Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad versus Schwab, you can absolutely say that there's no situs or status here because this is not a Schwab situation. And I will talk about that if the court wants.
Well, no doubt, you know, that the argument you're making is certainly made before the in-bank court, as I recall it, not to be debatable, but that the argument before us as a panel was that even under Winchester, you know, the claim had lost. I mean, it was not so much Winchester's wrong or wrongly decided, but that on this record, he lost, simply put. So anyway, we're sitting here in bank, so.
Yeah, and you're correct, Your Honor, because when we're talking to the panel can't overrule the decision in Winchester the way Winchester did with Purdue, which was an en banc. And so the point is that petitioner tried within the ambit of Winchester to try and pull it as far away using the Ninth Circuit precedent and the precedents from other courts, tried to do the best they could with it. But now that we are here, it was a futile act to try and ask you, Your Honor, as a three-judge panel, to overrule that decision. Now that we are here, the question is, do you put a Band-Aid on a problem and allow it to continue to fester for another 30 years? Or do you correct it right here and now the way the court has done many times, such as the last time I was here talking to this en banc court in Barrett versus Chevron?
You may have, and I may have missed it. Judge Southwick asked you what was the evidence, and evidence might not be the best term, but other than saying it, what's the indication in the record or otherwise that since Winchester, you know, there's sort of been an upheaval or the law's in disarray, et cetera? I mean, it's been on the books 30 years, and I certainly don't suggest just because of time that that's a reason something ought to stay there, but it just seems to be more argument than just to say that it's not the same as to say in the Fourth Circuit test under Sidwell. Well, what's the evidence that since Sidwell, you know, quantitatively X results? So what is it besides your argument that, you know, Winchester should be overruled as a matter of law? But what is the showing to be made that applying the Winchester test has, you know, I don't want to say upheaval, but has created difficulty by the administrative law judges, the processing of the cases, et cetera? Clearly, they have to apply the law in the circuit.
Well, and I go back to it once again. The critical case is how this court struggled to it and considered en banc and denied it en banc over the two members of this court, including Judge Smith, dissenting in that case.
The point seems to be from the government is that there have not been that many cases indicating confusion over a period of 32 years, and consequently it hadn't created that much of a problem. And Judge Stewart was suggesting that what is the litigation after Sidwell? Is it produced more or fewer cases than have been disputed in the Fifth Circuit?
Well, I'm sorry.
And the other thing that I imagine a lot of the confusion results as a practical matter that never reaches cases about whether there's insurance coverage or whether there's not insurance coverage or how to construct your business and that sort of thing.
If you look at the cases in the Benefits Review Board reporter and the ALJ cases, there are dozens and dozens of dozens. And I didn't come prepared to you today, but I can send you, if you want, I can send you cases to show you the number. But the courts have struggled with this mightily since the day it was decided. And in Sidwell, the Fourth Circuit said, we've had enough. And that's why the Fourth Circuit changed the law, because the courts continue to struggle with it. As I said, the best example here today is Hudson, because what is the area? What is the area? We just don't know what the area is after a case like Hudson, because it's not a discrete area like the court said. It's not. It's the only thing we know, according to the court, is that downtown Houston is not covered. That is a great exam question, and I love it, and I've asked that exam question so many times.
So at the moment, you don't have a reference to an empirical study?
There is no empirical study. I could do an empirical study for you.
You do reference Hudson as your best example for disarray. Is it your position that the error here and the error you perceive in Hudson is the same one as in Winchester, or did we take a step beyond Winchester? And so en banc revisiting of this issue could be just to correct the gloss in Hudson, or does it necessarily connect to Winchester?
Hudson is based upon Winchester.
I know it's based upon it, but does Hudson, in your mind, would it be valuable and a contribution for us to correct what we said in Hudson but not reverse Winchester?
Well, you can't do that, because what Hudson does is Hudson combines something that is not a discrete adjoining area.
But it does so by speaking about associated items. And if you look at it, a container as not a vessel but an associated item, that language doesn't appear in Winchester, and it doesn't appear in any of the Supreme Court cases. and yet it would seem to be implicated here if you distinguish between a container and a vessel.
Yeah, you can put a – I can give you many ways to put a Band-Aid on Winchester. The question is, when you have a case that presents the precise facts of Sidwell, is it time to correct the law or is it time to leave it when we know that it's not textual, it doesn't follow the language of the statute, it is completely contrary to the language of the statute?
And I have one other question. Mm-hmm. Again, I think you said you might get to Schwab.
Mm-hmm.
When I look at Schwab's language, the Supreme Court wrote, we are quite sure that employees who are injured while maintaining or repairing equipment essential to the loading are covered.
Mm-hmm.
That's broad language. One could argue that this individual was repairing equipment essential to loading. So how do you – and that's discussing 902 and 903. What's your thought on that phrase?
And that's exactly right, that it is – it's both of those sections that are involved in this. But the thing you have to understand about Schwab is this is what Schwab said, that aside from the specific occupations that are enumerated, land-based activity is deemed maritime only if it is an integral or essential part of loading or unloading a vessel. And then here's what the court said, Judge Higginson. The determinative consideration is that the ship process could not continue unless the equipment was operating properly. The determinative process. And the point is, they're actually working on the equipment that is loading the vessel. And as the court said, when they did the repairs, the loading operation stopped. Here, it is clear that the containers have come off the ship. They are not part of the loading operation, and the loading operation will continue regardless.
Well, my last question then, though, that would leave intact Winchester, because the gear room, if you couldn't touch, you agree. So that if that interpretation of Schwab doesn't have us reversing Winchester, it just applies to this case.
Correct. Okay. You can, as I said, you're absolutely right. You can put a Band-Aid on this and put your head in the sand, and you don't have to overturn Winchester.
Well, but it's not putting a Band-Aid on it if we're following Supreme Court law.
Well, it's
not Supreme Court. There's a geographical – you have the geographical and the functional component of the CITES test, don't you?
Yes. And that is why application of Schwab overturns the decision in this case, regardless of what you do with Winchester. Because the one thing that Winchester did
– okay.
The one thing that Winchester did was, yes, it said we don't care what a join means. Yes, it says we don't the area is not a discrete area. It can be anything short of downtown Houston. Yes. But it also said it still has to be – when they limited it by function, the court said it still has to be an area for loading and unloading a vessel. And that's not the case here.
Here.
No,
but
in
it would
this
have
case.
Been in Winchester.
Pardon?
It would have been in Winchester.
In Winchester, it is arguably,
yeah.
And you can save Winchester if you need to, because of the fact that in Winchester, the gear room, although it doesn't adjoin navigable waters, it was – he's repairing equipment
yes.
that's used, just like in Schwab, directly for
right.
the vessel loading. And it is possible that under a Schwab analysis – that the loading operation would cease.
In this, what does the record show about the repair of these containers? When they are brought into the repair shop, are they stacked up, and then another load comes in, and it takes them 2 or 3 weeks to get it repaired, and they put it back, and then maybe a month later somebody will pick it up? Is that
the testimony is on page 14 of the district of the administrative law judge Kennington's opinion. Prior to the discharge of a container by the offloading stevedore, Evergreen would look to the loading stevedore for liability for damage. In these cases, Evergreen would send the container to a local contractor to have the repairs done, and that's like this one. So if it's an offloading situation and they discover there's damage, they send it off-site for repairs.
Let me just ask you, in the real world, if someone like Sidwell or the plaintiff in our case is injured at a facility that's not abutting navigable waters, how do you know whether he's covered by the act or not, short of a hearing by the ALJ.
Well, that's the problem that you have in every case is, and I can get you the cases, and I can give you a litany of cases, but the problem that you have here is that this employer with a landlocked facility doesn't go out and get longshore insurance. That is a year in the federal penitentiary. Somebody, okay, if they're a mile away, do you get longshore or not? The point is, we need a rule. You're subjecting people to potential criminal liability in this type of situation because that you have to have longshore if you've got workers involved in longshoring operations. We can't sit here and continue to put Band-Aids on it. Let me finish one thing.
Well,
I'm sorry.
I had a question, though.
Mm-hmm.
Can you briefly articulate the appropriate standard of review that you advocate? You say de novo, but you mean that's for statutory interpretation. You don't mean that's for the factual findings, correct?
Can I just finish answering this one, and then I'll get to that,
sure.
Judge Elrod?
No, counsel, you've saved some time for rebuttal. Why don't you answer Judge Elrod's question, and then you can finish up on the other one. You can come back up on rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. The thing is that the standard of review in this case was set out correctly by all parties, in essence, because as the government said it so well in theirs, if you look at Wielander, McDermott versus Wielander, 498 U.S. 337, that's the case where Justice O'Connor set out in great detail how to address the coverage under 902 sub 3 sub G, which is the crew member exception. And she was dealing with who's covered under the Longshore Act versus who's excluded for seaman status. And she said,
Just the question put to you was articulate the standard of review, not give argument, but just, have you answered Judge Elrod's question?
It's a mixed question it's a mixed question of law and fact, and here's what she said. The court decides the legal standards with de novo review. The fact finder finds the facts subject to substantial evidence, but the court must not abdicate its duty to determine if a reasonable person would differ. If a reasonable person would differ, it's a question of fact for the fact finder. If the facts and law support only one conclusion, it's a summary judgment standard. That's what she said.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Diggleman. You've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal, so you'll have some time to make any other points you want to make. Thank you. All right. We'll now hear from New Orleans Marine, Mr. Quackenboss.
May it please the court. This is a case about the facts. And the ALJ in this situation made several determinations that were critical in making determination under both Fifth Circuit and Supreme Court precedent. The first is that the chef yard where this activity happened was used by NAZI to repair Evergreen's ocean-going containers that came into and departed the Port of New Orleans by vessel.
Also came through train, right? They would come in by train, perhaps.
Well, these
weren't loaded with cargo.
Correct.
They were not in transit, like in the Schwab situation.
In Schwab,
the fact that you had to repair them didn't stop any sort of loading or unloading, or have anything to do with loading or unloading, right?
No, I disagree. I mean,
why?
Because the AOJ found that Evergreen's loading and unloading operations in the Port of New Orleans could not have continued without the repair and maintenance work performed by NAZI.
But it wasn't a particular vessel that brought, like in Schwab, that brought a container that needed repair before it could continue in transit. These were just containers that showed up and needed repairs. It wasn't during the process of a particular loading or unloading.
No. Evergreen has a 17 million container fleet. Okay, so this is a situation where, you know, eventually, if this repair work is not performed, okay, the loading and unloading ceases to take place.
Right,
because
eventually.
Eventually, right. Because, and it was the solicitor's brief made a great argument about this, that if a crane goes down at a facility, the repair work performed on that crane is certainly going to be maritime in nature. But if the facility has other cranes available, they're not going to cease their loading and loading operations based upon the fact that one crane went down. And the same thing happens in this case. Just because one container may cease to be in an operational state the loading and unloading process that depends upon those containers being in a high-quality condition is really going to be dependent upon whether there's additional containers available. But if those additional containers continue to not be repaired, eventually the loading and unloading operation can't continue.
Eventually. Right.
And the 11th Circuit actually recognized that in the Atlantic Container versus Coleman decision, which is factually very similar to this case.
What's the activity?
Didn't they back off of that in the later decision?
I'm sorry, could you say it again?
The 11th Circuit had a later decision at the end of last year, Ramos, where they said that a container repair yard is not a covered site.
Correct, but in Ramos,
was differentiating Coleman.
Absolutely. In Ramos, though, and I don't remember the exact distance, the container repair facility was much further away from the waterfront than the container repair facility.
What difference does that make? I really don't understand that.
The geographic nexus component of the Winchester test requires the facility to be within the vicinity of navigable waters.
But so is downtown Houston. I really don't understand. If it had all the characteristics that you described, and that was the proper test, why couldn't it be downtown Houston?
There's a navigable bayou right through the middle of the downtown of Houston.
Absolutely.
That becomes the ship channel.
I see what you're saying.
One moment. Judge Owen had a question. So
sure.
If you will first respond to hers, and then we'll come back to this.
Okay. The downtown Houston example that was provided in the Winchester case was to show that it was actually phrased in such a way as, of course, downtown Houston. It was the outlier. It was the situation where, look, it would be absurd to think that downtown Houston could
That's illogical to me. I don't understand.
And that's what the court was saying in its opinion, that it's
illogical. No, I'm saying it's illogical to exclude downtown Houston if it's close to a navigable body and all of the activities that you describe were being carried on in downtown Houston.
Okay,
what difference does it make where it is? Under your test, why couldn't it be downtown Houston?
Well, to an extent, okay, I can see how you can extend it to a point. And I think, though, one thing you have to kind of keep in mind is that the Longshore Act, when it was amended in 1972, was meant to extend coverage to workers on land that were performing activities that were previously covered, but only beyond the Jensen line or upon navigable water. So we want to extend that coverage to a point, okay, in that vicinity. But I think once you get beyond the geographical confines, which of course is a moving line depending on the case.
I just don't understand what the city limits of Houston has to do with that geographic line if it's just as close to an area just like you're describing and the exact same work is being conducted.
Well, downtown Houston, and I can't remember who had said this before, but maybe 5 miles from the waterfront, whereas in this case we're talking about a facility that's 300 yards.
Let me ask you this. What if the facility was 2 miles from the port of Houston? How would either the employer or the employee know whether he's covered by the Longshoreman's Act? Short of a hearing by an ALJ.
Sure. I think if you look at the Ramos case that Judge Clement had referred to a minute ago, that shows you that 2 miles is probably a bit much. I'm sorry.
I said probably.
Yeah, right. But there's also the functional component of the test, which says.
Well, let's say it meets the functional component. Let's say there are other maritime industries in the area, and it's 2 miles from the port. Now, how does he know whether comes under the state act or the federal act?
Well, I think you have to look at the work that they're performing. That's why the functional.
Well, I said assume it meets the functional test.
Okay. Well, I mean, there is not a fine line that draws that distinction. The Supreme Court in the Caputo case looked at a situation where Blundo, one of the two claimants, had been he was actually stripping containers after a container had been brought from Brooklyn, okay, by road to that facility. Now, in that case, they were rejecting the point of rest theory. But obviously, that container, if it's covered, and the work that's being performed after it had been brought across land, I mean, in theory, it can extend very far.
Isn't there a fine line in the statute? Excuse me.
Hold up 1 second.
I thought he was finished answering.
Yeah, let me get Judge Jolly and then we'll come back.
The point it seems to me that Judge Davis is underscoring here. If it's 2 miles, you say probably. Well, what about 2.5 miles? Well, less probably. What about 3 miles? Well, maybe not. I mean, there is absolutely no certainty of any kind with respect to the Winchester test. That's Seems obvious to me.
Is there a question?
I think you have to agree that the problem is the word in the statute.
Judge Higginson, if you want, I thought Judge Jolly had a question, but he was had an exclamation point. To Judge Clement, if we will.
You said that there was no fine line, but isn't there in fact a fine line established by the statute itself? Section 903A requires the adjoining area be customarily used by an employer in loading and unloading. And your area is the area of the repair facility is far removed from loading and unloading. It's not customarily used for that. It's customarily used for repairing, not vessels, but containers, empty containers. So why isn't the statute itself defining an adjoining area as in Sidwell? Why isn't that a fine line?
Okay. In terms of Sidwell, when we're talking about the geographic component, I'll just say this. The geographic component has been admitted by NADSE. In fact, I don't think it's actually before the court because their brief to this court initially was it is not contested in this appeal that the geographic nexus component of the test has been satisfied. That being said, in terms of whether the activity at the chef yard had to do with loading and unloading, I think that the AOJ found that that it did because they were performing repairs on the items that were essential to the loading and unloading process and the continuation of loading and unloading in the Port of New Orleans by everybody.
May I ask a hypothetical? When I was thinking about this, suppose you're in California and suppose you've got some vineyard that's located near the coast and the vineyard makes casks for wine and the wine travels in the casks in ships and the casks are broken. Are the people who make the oak casks at the vineyard longshoremen? If it's in proximity to the water? We've got to go to the ALJ for that, don't we?
Absolutely. And I think that's what happened in this case. I mean,
isn't that a reductio ad absurdum?
Arguably. But I don't think that, I mean, I think we're getting into situations that aren't present here. I mean, this is container repair. I mean, the loading and unloading.
I ask if the question's been answered? May I ask a question?
Go ahead. Just jump.
I think you've got two problems with the statute. One is just the difficulty that Congress gave you the word adjoin. If the word adjoin means contiguous, then the questions you're being asked are decisive. But if the word adjoin means near to, and in a world of helicopters and containers that are going far inshore, then you rely on the next clause, which is, okay, even if it's not contiguous, is it essential to and customarily used in the loading and unloading? That gets you inshore, at least according to Winchester. My difficulty with this case, though, is what is that area being used for? What enumerated activity of the five in 903? Do you acknowledge that this is a repair area, or is this a loading area?
This is a repair area, just as the gear room.
Okay, not just as. So it's a repair area, but then it is repairing an item that isn't the vessel. I know containers today almost look like vessels. All they are the hull and then all the containers. But I am unable to see myself that the container is the vessel, and the statute requires the vessel. So my difficulty is the enumerated activities that are covered. It's not the Winchester, too far, where are we going to draw the line? Do you have a thought on that?
Yes, I do. In Caputo, the Supreme Court recognized that the container is the modern equivalent for the hold of the vessel.
Okay. Well, Justice, that was Friendly's remark, but I don't think you've got a case yet that's saying what we really now have is these vessels are being brought 2 miles inshore because the containers operate like a hold. And is that your position, that these are vessels in there being worked on?
My position is that the container repair work is essential and integral to the loading and unloading.
That was ongoing.
Okay. But I was responding to your question concerning the containers in equivalent to the vessel. So
okay.
Just to clarify.
That's fine. Thank you.
It seems to me part of the problem is that we've decoupled the two elements under the statute, and that should be more synthesized than the test in Winchester said they are. It means you can't, it seems to me you cannot decouple adjoining from the customarily used for loading and unloading. It's sort of a seamless process. And once you get physically too attenuated from the unloading and loading process, they can't co- it's not just a 1-2 or I think we put too much distance between those terms, it seems to me, in Winchester.
We're asking the question, is it close to or in the vicinity of the navigable water? And I think but that's not even an issue in this case.
Well, I think it seems to me it is, because you have to look at the language as a whole. If you're looking at adjoining and customarily used for loading and unloading, it seems to me you can't decouple that. You can't say, well, they conceded the geographic piece. If you're going to look at the proper interpretation of the statute, you have to take the statute as a whole and not in discrete elements, as you seem to ask us to do.
Okay. Well, I don't know if you had a specific question on that one. But.
Oh, it seems it's not to me. It's not so much of a waiver question, is it? It's if you're looking at the statute as a whole, what are we talking? What was Congress trying to get at?
Right. Well, I mean, I think anytime you look at the statute, there's certain words that are going to be. I guess people are going to hang on those words a little bit and to see what they mean in terms of interpreting it and applying it into a real-world situation. I just think insofar as adjoin is concerned in this case, that adjoin is not even at issue because they say when they got to the Fifth Circuit that this has already been acknowledged, that this is in the vicinity of navigable waters. We don't contest that point. So really all the court's asked to do in this case is say, is there a functional nexus? And I think the facts show that there definitely is, because without the work that Evergreen performed, I mean, I'm sorry, that NAZI performed for Evergreen, their loading and unloading operations in the port of New Orleans would have been shut down. They could not have continued.
Now, that's not really correct, is it? Because these are empty containers. You're not dealing with a vessel that's being loaded or unloaded. So you can't shut down the loading and unloading process just because you have some damaged containers willy-nilly waiting to be repaired. They're empty. It's a repair yard.
But that's the issue that was highlighted in the solicitor's brief, which is that's a product of your financial capabilities. If a company smaller than Evergreen with less containers that can't just, when a damaged container comes off a ship, can't just switch the cargo from one container into the other container and send the damaged one to get repaired right there at a nearby facility, or when the damage is caused by the offloading contractor, by them on the spot, then the actual transport of the cargo is stopped.
Mr. Quackenbos, if the question of the vagueness of this test is subject to empirical study, I suggest to you that the question of how many container owners there are who are that small is also subject to empirical analysis.
Thank you.
Would you agree with that?
It certainly is a good point. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Quackenbos. We'll hear from Mr. Boyle.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Your Honors, I would like to take us back briefly to Judge Elrod's question about the standard of review in this case. Under the standard of review, the Court has to ask two questions about the two coverage issues. The first one is, did the ALJ apply the correct legal standard? And the second one is, if he did he reach a reasonable conclusion? Now, there hasn't been a great deal of discussion about status here today, so I will go to situs for starters. Before I do that, though, I would like to address a couple of Judge Clement's points about the fact that a loading process would not actually have stopped immediately if Mr. Zepeda had stopped working on these containers. And that is true, and that was what happened in Schwab. The difference here is that I don't think you need to show that. Now, certainly if a piece of equipment breaks down and loading stops immediately, that is sufficient to show that it is essential to loading. But if loading does not immediately stop, that is not sufficient to show that it is not a piece of equipment that is essential to loading. The crane example that we give in our brief with South Carolina port having 11 cranes out, A big storm comes through. Four of those cranes get taken out. The port assures everyone we can continue loading because we have these seven other cranes. Does that mean those four cranes that broke down are not equipment essential to loading? I don't think so, because other than the container ship itself and the containers themselves, there is really nothing more essential to loading a container ship than a crane.
Well, the cranes are on the dock.
Yes, they are, Your Honor, but that's a situs. That's a situs question. I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Totally adjacent to the loading and unloading activity.
They are, Your Honor, and I'll get to that in a moment. That's more of a situs question than a status question, though. The question under Schwab is whether this is equipment that is essential to the loading of ships.
I mean, at some point, it seems to me, though, you get too remote to the loading and unloading process, essential and integral to the loading and unloading process, whenever you have a repair shop in which you've got stacks and stacks of retainers that some may go out on land transportation, some may go out in maritime transportation, and they may go out 6 or 7 months later. I mean, it just seems at some point it becomes so remote that you cannot say that it is essential and integral to the loading process of a vessel. Do you agree with that?
I think that is a possibility, Your Honor. The problem is that we don't have any information in this case about how long these containers were there, when they went out, because NODSI testified that it didn't have any information. It said, we have no idea where these containers came from. We have no idea where they're going afterwards. So the ALJ had to draw the inference from somebody else's testimony that some of these were going out to ships and coming from ships.
Or how long they remained there. I mean, that's...
We don't know, Your Honor. It's simply not on the record. But if I can go back to Winchester, I think it is pretty clear that in Winchester, the panel made it very clear that there was no loading going on the day that Mr. Winchester was fixing whatever it was he was fixing that day in the gear room. And there was no finding that loading would have stopped that day because there was no loading going on. But the court found nonetheless that the gear room itself was a covered situs and that Mr. Winchester was doing covered employment because he was doing something, he was repairing equipment that was essential to the loading of ships. Not that loading would stop if he didn't do it immediately, but eventually things would stop if these things were not
prepared. But are you focusing on maritime employment 902? Or are
yes,
you saying
Your Honor.
It's, yeah, but what about 903, the customary use, which focuses on the use of the area?
Yes, Your Honor.
And if we just look at that, the statute's pretty clear. We're looking at five enumerated activities.
Correct, Your Honor.
And it seems to me this inward shoreside facility was a repairing facility.
As was the gear room in Winchester, Your Honor.
Two gear rooms were right next to it, so you don't even look at customary use there, right? Because they
correct,
aren't adjoining, they're contiguous. And the third one just happened to be a little bit closer. I don't personally see that geographic stuff worth a controlling analysis. To me, this facility, 300 yards inward, is a facility, and it fits into one of the enumerated uses in the statute. It's a repair facility. And then you ask under the statute, repair of what? And the statute's clear. It's repair of vessels. So the only way, in my mind, you get to containers is if you do what this court did in Hudson and say, well, also associated items. But I don't find the Supreme Court ever having said that, because associated items could, as the dissent pointed out, include shoes. It could include any number of things as far back in the process as you want.
I think I have an answer for you.
Okay.
In Winchester, the court found that the gear room itself, no actual loading went on there. But it also found that for purposes of Section 3A, it was used for loading. Court's exact words.
Right.
In this case, both the overall area and the gear room were used for loading. So what the court did there was the same thing that the court did in Schwab under Section 2.3, which was say, look, the statute talks about loading. We think that the repair of loading equipment is closely affiliated enough with loading that it qualifies. That's exactly what the court did in Schwab. And if you look, and that makes perfect sense with regard to 3A, because the Supreme Court said that status is an occupational test that is focused on loading, but we find that repair of loading equipment meets that test. Functional nexus is also a test focused on loading, so the court could very reasonably find, under Supreme Court law, using Schwab, that the repair of loading equipment also meets the functional nexus test. In fact, if you look at the two statutes side by side, it becomes, I think, even clearer that you can do that, because an adjoining area under 3A can be used for repairing a vessel. An employee includes a ship repairman. An adjoining area under 3A can be used for dismantling a vessel. Under 2.3, an employee includes a ship breaker, one who dismantles vessels. An adjoining area can be one used for the building of a vessel. Under 2.3, an employee includes a ship builder. An adjoining area under 3A can be used for loading or unloading. An employee includes anyone engaged in longshoring operations, which commonly understood means loading or unloading.
Well, Mr. Boyle, if what you're saying is that the functional component is the same in both sections, doesn't that place additional weight on the necessity of interpreting adjoining very carefully, because otherwise you're collapsing the two sections?
To a certain extent, yes, Your Honor, but I don't think we are collapsing the sections.
Well, then what's wrong with my wine cask hypothetical?
Can you repeat it for me, Your Honor?
I said you're up in Northern California. There's a vineyard that ships wine abroad in casks. It is next to the navigable. It is near the navigable waters or some river that flows into navigable that flows into the sea. The casks go on to the vessel, and therefore the people who make the oak casks at the winery are longshoremen.
I think that's probably a bit too far, Your Honor, because...
Well, how can it be too far?
Because what...
Under what you've just been talking about, the function, they go on the vessel, they're part of the vessel, they're repairing the cask, therefore they're repairing part of the vessel, and it's very close to navigable waters under my hypothetical.
Yes, Your Honor, it is very close, but I would say that what the winemakers are doing is being winemakers. There's really nothing maritime about winemaking.
Well,
there is something
international
maritime.
Winemakers, for Pete's sake.
They're
involved in global transportation.
They're not, Your Honor. I respectfully disagree. I think they're involved in primarily winemaking. And what Mr. Zepeda and
Nazi...
Suppose
you're twisting my hypothetical.
Because what she's asking, I think, is the box itself. Vessels,
talking about the cask.
Long
exactly.
ago, vessels...
Could, for all we know, they could get their wine from Two-Buck Chuck and be sending that over to Japan or something.
It's a container. That's the same argument. It's a container.
It's slippery slope because long ago, antiquity, it's a clay urn. But would you say the people that repair the urns that happen to be the prevailing mode of containerization on the ship, are they longshoremen? I just don't see the people repairing whatever, the hemp rope that used to be used. Now we've got containers.
Well,
I don't think of those people as longshoremen.
Well, to be clear, Your Honor, historically there were longshoremen who were called coopers, and they
right.
did exactly what Judge Jones is talking about. They fixed the barrels and the crates in which things were shipped, and they were clearly covered employees. But I think there is a much closer connection between fixing a shipping container, which is used primarily for shipping, and a barrel, which is used primarily for storing wine.
But we also know that this particular kind of shipping container is put on trucks and it's put on railroads, that, you know, it's a multi-purpose container, just like a box, just like a cardboard box.
That's correct, Your Honor. But
so the people who make the cardboard boxes at Georgia Pacific, if those get loaded on the vessels, they're longshoremen too.
No, Your Honor, because the Supreme Court has not extended the status test to people who manufacture things that might eventually be used on.
Oh, I say, I'm sorry. Okay.
But has there been disarray or problem in the Fourth Circuit in its ports with the contiguity rule?
No more or less than there has been here, Your Honor.
Right. It's because that seems to, if Congress's purpose in amending in 72 any of this was not to have the oddity of a guy walking off a vessel in and out of covered territory.
Well, that was one of the goals, Your Honor. But
and that we're not worrying about that particularly. We don't have anyone from vessels ending up at this chef wharf that we know of.
Correct, Your Honor. But that was also the case with all of the claimants in Schwab and all of the claimants in Pfeiffer versus Ford, because as the Supreme Court recognized, while the Congress did want to prevent people who were covered
out.
Only part of the time before 1972 from walking in and out of coverage, so they wanted them to be covered all the time. Congress also made it very clear that they wanted people who were completely land-based to be covered, even if they would not have been covered even part of the time before 1972. So I think the potential that a worker could walk into in and out of coverage is a reason to find his workplace a covered situs. But the lack of that potential for another employee is not necessarily a bar to finding a covered status.
But in Schwab, the workers were actually injured on the wharf, were they not?
That's correct, Your Honor. So that
you didn't have the problem of not being at a facility on adjoining.
Correct, Your Honor. So the court didn't have to interpret adjoining area, but really that's as far as Schwab gets us on situs. They said it's one of the enumerated situses, so we don't have to worry about what the interpretation of adjoining area is.
Mr. Bolton, for this to work, it seems to me that not just the point of walking in and out of coverage, but the sense of this is that the navigable water has some relationship to the activity. And it seems to me in this case, unlike any of the other cases we're talking about, this navigable water, there's no evidence that the activity of the container repair had any connection to the water that coincidentally happened to be flowing by. It was cheap land or whatever else. Is it the position of the government that there is no relationship requirement in the navigable water? I mean, in the gear room, it's six blocks from the actual, in Winchester, piers where these operations were going on. You had the problem of walking in and out of coverage. You have to drive in and out of coverage from, I don't know how far we are from a relevant port. So is there, in your position, no need to connect the navigable water to the activity so long as in downtown Houston you have a navigable bayou flowing by? You then look at the function that's going on, and if it's close enough to the navigable bayou, the fact they don't use the bayou is relevant?
No, that is not our position, Your Honor. In fact,
so how does it apply in our case if that's not your position? Because there's no evidence, is there? I mean, maybe my premise is wrong. Is there evidence that this industrial canal, what do we call this? Whatever this canal is, had a relationship to the activity on the chef yard?
What the evidence of the relationship is, Your Honor, is that Evergreen had containers on other people's ships. The Evergreen ships themselves did not call on the Port of New Orleans. They had a space-sharing agreement with another shipping line, which is apparently pretty typical. They would put their containers on these ships, which would come in, they would take these containers off these ships, and if they were damaged, they would send them to Nassau.
But was that going on anywhere near the chef yard?
We don't know, Your Honor. I think it's fair to say yes, though, because when Mr. Zepeda worked for NAMSI, his prior employer, which was a stevedoring company, and for which he did container repair, they were right across the Industrial Canal on France Road. And if you look at a map of all of these areas, it's really the Mississippi flows into the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet, and the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet splits with the Industrial Canal in a pretty compact area. So even if they were loading on the Mississippi or on the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet, I think the court could reasonably find that these containers had a close enough functional nexus.
But the 300 yards that's in the evidence is 300 yards to navigable waters, not 300 yards to a pier or a wharf or something involved in Evergreen's operation.
Correct.
I mean, it's clear there was no pier or wharf on the Intercoastal Canal anywhere adjacent to or near the chef yard, right?
There's not, Your Honor, but I think there is a bigger question in that there was testimony in the record that there were marine facilities in the area and there were other container facilities.
In the area, but what does that mean?
Well, neighboring it, Your Honor. In fact, the one thing that is not answered, if I can finish answering your question, is there was a coffee plant directly next to NAMSI, a coffee roasting plant, and it is not clear, for reasons that are not clear to me, whether this coffee roasting plant got its coffee unloaded from ships or loaded it back onto ships. It seems to me that if you're going to put a coffee roasting plant on the water, that would be a likely place to do it, but we don't have the evidence to answer that question.
Well, you're just guessing at that, aren't you? You're just guessing at that. The chef yard it's the Chef Mentor Highway. So, I mean, you can't just say, oh, I presumed that the coffee was going to go
by
the Intercoastal Canal. I mean, there's a highway there. They've got trucks that take coffee.
Agreed, Your Honor. I'm simply saying if the court feels after this that it needs to know what the neighboring area was, that might be a good question to direct the ALJ to find out.
Counsel, I'm still troubled with the standard review. Are you saying that if the ALJ makes a determination with regard to situs that is unmoored to the statutory text, that the only thing that we can review that for is whether or not there's evidence in the record? That appears to be apples and oranges.
Not at all, Your Honor. That is not what I'm saying. I'm saying the court gets to define the legal standard. If the court finds that the ALJ applied the incorrect legal standard,
if it's using the, it's not applying the statute correctly, we can de novo look at that.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Mr. I had a lingering question, but I'll take it to the conference room with me. All right, we're back to you, Mr. Ingram. You have a rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. A couple points that I do want to make. There's one takeaway that I want the court to have from my argument, one of them, and that is the public policy issue, because the Supreme Court dealt with that expressly in Herb's Welding versus Gray, which came from this court. And the issue in that was talked about the liberal interpretation of the act, talked about workers walking in and out of coverage, talked about leaving gaps, talked about the necessity of a fine line drawn in the sand versus having a more amorphous line. And what Justice White did in that case was, after he'd actually flown in a helicopter offshore when he was here for the judicial conference before that case was heard, he said, first, let's look at congressional intent here. And congressional intent for this statute was, as Sidwell said, as the dissenters in Winchester said, it was for workers injured on adjoining piers or docks to have uniform coverage so that they did not step in and out of coverage. And then after doing that, he said there was no basis for extending the coverage beyond the literal language of the statute. And then he said, now, there are always going to be boundaries. No matter what you do, there are always going to be boundaries. And there's always going to be people, there are always going to be people who cross those boundaries back and forth. And no matter how you construe this, there are always going to be checkerboards and people who walk in and out of coverage and places where there are not coverage. But he said, it's our job to interpret the statute the way it's written. And if you try to correct all the wrongs of the world, the act is going to reach much farther than anyone argues or than it should. And here's the takeaway. And this is the critical point for us all here today. Justice White said the same thing in 1969 in the Nassarima versus Johnson case, Nassarima versus Johnson, which is at 396-212. That's what he said in that case. And in that case, the statute at that time dealt with just navigable waters and no further. And he said, it's not for us to right the wrongs of the world. What we have to do is interpret it and draw the line exactly the way Congress said. So what happened after that? Is that it did go to Congress. He said, in that opinion, make your appeal to Congress. And the parties did. And you know what Congress did? Congress did what it does. Congress made sausage. That's what Congress does. They took and they corrected all sorts of things. They took the mere $70 a week and increased it so that it's now $1,400 a week in compensation. They took the coverage and they extended it shoreside to the piers and wharves adjoining so that there would not be people walking in and out of coverage for that longshoring. And they said exactly what they meant in the legislative history, as the dissenters in Winchester and the majority in Sidwell said. But what they did was, the court then did away with the warranty of seaworthiness as a balance for the ship owners. It did away with the warranty of workmanlike performance that was plaguing the employers, the stevedoring companies. Congress did what Congress does. Congress said, okay, you drew the line, we agree, the line should be moved, that's our decision, and we're going to take something from you, we're going to give something here, and they made great sausage in the 72 amendments. That's what Congress does. This court is not a sausage maker. That's not this court's job.
This court made a decision, though, in Winchester, which at least in part was based on a concern that everybody who was doing longshoreman's kind of work couldn't be located right on the waterfront. Wasn't that one of the concerns and a basis for the decision, a recognition that there was just not enough space that everyone could be located on the waterfront? But that didn't mean they weren't doing the same kind of work.
That's exactly right, Your Honor, but that...
Well, are those concerns no longer legitimate concerns?
Those are legitimate concerns, but what Justice White said in Nacirema and what he said in Herb's Welding when those exact arguments were presented to him, to the Supreme Court, I'm sorry, in Herb's Welding was, that's not our job. Our job is, if you want more than what we said, please direct those to Congress. And then Congress will do the balance. Congress may say, we're going to give those and we're going to take from the stevedore, we're going to give to the stevedore something else. That's what Congress does.
And wasn't the intent of the 72 amendments to protect the longshoremen on the vessel or on the dock on either end of the gangway? Only to deal with loading and unloading cargo from vessels or repairing vessels. I mean, that was pretty limited.
And that's exactly what Justice White said when he quoted the legislative history, and he reviewed the legislative history in Herb's Welding. He did that, and that's exactly what he said when he said, we cannot extend this past what Congress said.
If you're right and Congress gave a sausage, and then Justice White points out, and his language again is somebody repairing equipment essential to loading? And I do think what you've got here is in the last 20 years since most of these decisions, you've got a virtual decimation of longshoremen. There are no more gangplanks. It's all containers and it's helicopters. And so the ports that are contiguous don't exist. There wasn't the land. All the big ports now are huge spaces of land inward. The exact same loading and unloading activity is just done shoreside. That's where the space is. So using the logic and the language of the Supreme Court, equipment essential to loading, if the reality now is you've got to have the loading in a bigger space because there's so many more containers, I would see that his language that you're relying on is exactly controlling here.
It's exactly the same point that we faced in Nacirema, and Justice White drew the line because that's exactly what Congress had said. And it's the same thing as he said in Herb's Welding and as the dissenters. It's amazing that you say this because that's what the dissenters in Winchester said. The dissenters in Winchester said, the invitation to move the line must be addressed to Congress. The court should not shy away from the task because it effectively excludes workers given the realities of modern maritime activities. The point is, yes, Congress may choose to move the line further as longshoring moves inward. But that is directed to Congress, and Congress may say, we're going to balance that some way. And that's what Congress did in 1972.
Well, the point, I think the dissenters make a better point, or that under the statute, area is not defined by function. Rather, maritime function modifies or narrows coverage within the geographical area. And then I ellipsis a bit. Otherwise, there's no point in having a CITES test.
And that's correct. But I believe that the dissenters, which match Sidwell, are exactly in line with the language of the statute. You take the word adjoin, comes from the Latin word, comes from ad to, and jungo jungere, which means join, gives us the same word as joint, which to me meant things that are attached together to a different generation, it means something else. But in any event, that word means join. It means join to,
right.
And that's the definition.
Lots, long, long ago, lots of us on this court heard exactly that argument. Mm-hmm. And a join is a little bit elastic. It has multiple definitions. It does also modify the word area. And third, and maybe most convincing to me, if you have an exact contiguity rule, what about the employer that buys land with this 5-foot separation point? Are you then obliged to say people 5 feet hopping over aren't covered?
And that's exactly what the court in Sidwell said. It's exactly what the court said in the dissent. And it's exactly.
But what's your answer to that?
It's the same thing as Justice White said.
No, I'm asking you what your answer is to an employer that buys a 3-foot line of separation. Can he then deny coverage to the people not exactly contiguously connected? Yes or no?
Yes. And the reason. reason is because we're here to interpret the statute the way Congress wrote it. Congress wrote it requiring the word adjoin, and if you look at every dictionary on the planet, the first definition, the common definition, the one everybody looks at, is to be contiguous and to join to. And yes, you can find a 1960s Webster dictionary that whose fourth definition says nearby, and yes, you can do that, but when Congress uses a word, they don't pick the fourth definition from a 1960 Webster dictionary. They use the definition that is commonly used, that's number one in everybody's dictionary.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Grant.
Thank you.
We thank all counsel for your arguments in the case. I do want to note that in addition to the judges here in the courtroom, Judge Carolyn King will be participating in the in-bank decision. She could not be here today, but she will listen to the oral argument tape. Judge King was then Judge Randall, who was the dissenter, wrote a dissent in the Winchester case, so she will be fully participating. We thank you for your arguments and your brief. The case will be submitted.